Accession number 26803, reel 3.
George Co, reel 3. Is there anything else you want to say about your time as a radio instructor before we move on? About your time as a radio instructor.
And what about it?
Is there anything else you want to add?
Hansons, yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
No, not really. Just kept on and on, did various exercises day by day. There was really nothing to add. You don't want to know the equipment we're using, do you?
Yes, I mean, if you want to describe that.
Well, the radio equipment used there at the time was called a 1154-1155. This was a transmitter receiver. Communicating with the ground. It was fitted in various commands, bomber command, coastal command, to tune up the equipment, you turn the dial, which was situated on the left, but it had what they call click stops. So if you wanted to change frequency, you merely rotated the knob until it clicked at your required position. So you didn't have to do an awful lot of tuning. You just went over, click, and there you were on frequency. This equipment incorporated direction finding facilities. The aerial was connected to the loop aerial mounted on top of the aircraft, so that as you swung the loop aerial, so you would get a bearing from a ground station. So that was the equipment. Additionally, there was usual intercom between the radio and the other crew members. Okay? So we get to a point now where I'm now posted to another squadron, 519 squadron. Now, this was because after you did a rest period, you went back to a squadron. And in this particular case, I went back onto a squadron which was part of Coastal Command and started off again with Hudson aircraft. Eventually, though, we converted, we changed aircraft, and then used Venturas. Now, the squadron we were on was located up in Scotland, and the object was to provide coverage over the North Sea and even into the Arctic Circle. So we were on the lookout all the time for anything that was in that area. We carried meteorological instruments in order to report the weather, because at this time we were preparing for D-Day, and so they wanted to keep updating the weather. We also carried some depth charges and the usual guns. We operated in the main two main operations. One was called Operation Recipe, and the other was called Operation Rhombus. The Rhombus aircraft was operated by Hudson's, and on the outbound track went towards the Skagerrak. The inbound track, however, went to an aerodrome in Norfolk near Bertram's Newton, RAF Bertram Newton. And then, having landed at this aerodrome in Norfolk. We would stay the night and off again the next morning on the reciprocal track back to our base at Wick. So we were located at RAF Wick. The second operation was called Recipe and consisted of flying due north as far as we could go up to towards the Arctic Circle and back again. Mind you, before actually setting course, we had to skirt round the naval base Scapa Flow, because one of our pilots one day come back having been hit by a shell because he went over Scapa Flow. But anyway, normally we skirted round Scapa Flow and then set course. We were doing searching for ray for any ships, and meteorological observations. Now, the meteorological observations were that we went to a particular datum point and then climbed up to another level and up and up and up until we reached the top of our climb, taking observations all the time. Now, once we had collected observations, these were coded up by the navigator, or later a special met observer, and these were coded up and transmitted by me back to base. And so this was happened two or three times during a trip. I would add at this point that the squadron began to expand. We first of all converted to Venturas, then we converted to B-17s, the American Fortress, and finally we converted to Halifax aircraft. So we did these trips night and day, running a regular program. We lost one or two aircraft, they crashed, but by and large we didn't do so badly at all. So this went on. I suppose my tour on this was about 20 months. By this time, of course, the war had come to an end, and I was tour expired, and that was it. I kicked around various odd jobs. By this time, I had obtained my commission, and eventually, in 1946, I was demobilised from the RAF.
So you end up as a flight lieutenant?
Yes. During my earlier part, I was promoted from sergeant to flight sergeant, then to warrant officer, and finally I got my commission, then promoted to, got my commission to pilot officer, then up to flying officer, and at the end, I was awarded the Air Force Cross and demobilised. I was awarded the Air Force Cross in the New Year's Honours list and then was demobilised. So that was end of my flying career in the Royal Air Force. So there were times in the future when I'd still be back with the Royal Air Force, but we perhaps will go on with that a bit later.
So you were demobilised in
1946? I was demobilised in 1946, May.
Do you remember anything about being demobilised, the process?
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's another story. My demobilisation. I was given all my papers and told to report to Wembley for my final signing out. So I reported to Wembley, which is in just North London. In fact, it was just at the back of the Wembley Stadium. And I went in with loads of others. Of course, when you had your commission, you were allowed to keep your uniform. So there was no problem about that. But I used to have to get into line then and pick up my demobilisation kit, size of shoes. Do you want a double-breasted or a single-breasted suit? And do you want a grey or a brown? And you had a trilby hat. And a raincoat. But then that was the end of that. So, having collected up my kit, they gave me an oblong cardboard box. And as I got back on the train, there were loads of other cardboard boxes there. The end of an era. Right, so
how
stop
you...
then for a minute.
Yes, of course. Before we move on from your RAF career, you were awarded the RAF Cross.
Yeah.
Was that for any particular incident?
Well, not that I can recall. I mean, I wasn't... I didn't hang out of a blazing aircraft or anything like that. But there was one occasion which might have helped in this aspect, and that was the trailing aerial incident. The B-17s, along with many other aircraft, had what they call a trailing aerial, which in flight you could wind out to assist in your radio communications. This trailing aerial was equipped with a dozen or so large ball bearings, and so the trailing aerial would trail out slightly below the aircraft along behind. Well, one day there was a lot of static about, and I decided to wind in the trailing aerial. This was by electric motor on the B-17. And so I operated the switch, but it stuck. So I went back to the tail gunner's position. At that point in time, we didn't need a tail gunner, but the position was still there. And I went back to the tail gunner's position to see if I could see anything. And apparently what had happened, as the aircraft progressed, it corkscrewed on its path. And so, of course, the trailing aerial would wave about in a corkscrew fashion. And I could see lumps of this trailing aerial hanging over the tail fin, the tail plane. So what has happened was that in one of the corkscrews it had picked up this trailing aerial, and so it was getting jammed. So what I did was, and I opened the window right at the back there, managed to get my arm and shoulder out a little, and grabbed hold of this aerial and bit by bit pulled it inside the aircraft. So we had the trailing aerial there, half of it was inside the aircraft and the other bit was outside. But gradually I was able to pull this wire in until it was clear of the tailplane.
What would have happened if it had remained
well,
wrapped around?
Well, if it had jammed in the elevators, the aircraft would dive if it had jammed. Fortunately, I was able to pull it clear and pull it into the fuselage of the aircraft. And that was it. fortunately okay, we landed back at base. So I often wondered whether this was part of being this. In addition, I had done a lot of hours, more than many others. And but there it was. I received my letter from the King awarding me the Air Force Cross. And that was it. The other, I don't know if you want to know about the other. In addition, I got the usual group of medals. There was the 1939-45 medal. Then there was the Atlantic Star. Then there was the Defence Medal of the UK. And then at the end was a General War Medal. So that was my string of medals.
What happened to you after you left the Air Force?
Well, I myself was spot of leave. I went up, I'd flown with an old colleague of mine who got married to a friend of Margaret's, and we met up at a party when she was getting engaged or married, and so that's how I met my wife in 1946. And so anyway, so the situation was that I knew that the civil market might blossom out, and so I applied for a post with BOAC. Incidentally, I think I might go back a little bit here to say that during my last few months in the RAF, a notice came out asking people to be seconded to BOAC for a period of 12 or 18 months. So I put my request in to the RAF to be seconded to BOAC. But they came back and said, well, you're so near to your demobilisation, we can't accept it unless you sign on for 18 months. Well, I didn't want to hang about for 18 months because you didn't know what the future held. And so I decided to refuse this. And when I was home on my demob leave, I wrote in to BOAC asking for post as radio officer, which I got. So a few weeks later, I'm up for interview about Morse code test and a radio theory test, and an interview. And within a few weeks, I was in. So at that point, then I started to continue my flying as a civilian then on the various routes to the Middle East, India, the Far East, Australia, South Africa, etc. And I had a 2-year contract and just continued flying to and from, carrying passengers on scheduled timetable.
Can you describe what that was like? What was it like running passenger
aircraft? Flying with BOAC with passengers was very calm and sedate. We're still flying in Yorks, and crew of four, a pilot, first officer, navigator and radio officer, and then of course the cabin crew, which looked after the passengers. The York at that time was split up into two sections. There was a first class section and a second class section. The total number of passengers, usually about 14 passengers. But of course, it was comfortable seating, etc. Just about that time, VOAC, in a mad moment, decided to offer a sleeper service, whereby the seats could be folded down and converted into a bunk or bed. Now, unfortunately, they instituted this service off takeoff from Cairo on the way back. But of course, the rules here with BOAC that the passengers had to be fully seated and strapped in until they reached cruising height. Now, the aircraft would take off and it would climb to its cruising height, and which might take half an hour, 500 feet a minute climb. So they had to stay in their seats until the aircraft reached cruising height. Then they would get up, stand in the aisle, and wait for the bunks to be made up by the stewardess. The stewardess would move on to the next bunk and so on. Well, by the time all this took place, we were halfway between Cairo and Castle Bonito, which was the next port of call. By the time that all the passengers had been bunked down, it was time for the aircraft to descend into Castle Bonito. So, in fact, if you're at the wrong part of the queue, you only got about 10 minutes sleep. So eventually that was abandoned and we went back to normal. Right.
What was your role exactly? I was a
radio officer. Communications were bad. So the aircraft would take off from Heathrow and initially be under the control of the Uxbridge Air Traffic Control Centre on WT Communications, that's the Morse code. Halfway across the channel, one would then come under the control of French Air Traffic Control, and they will continue, and so it would continue, control centre, and then say Italian control centre and so on. So the role of the radio officer was to maintain communications, because the VHF channels we use today were rather limited in range, so you couldn't really use VHF in those days. As you move from one air traffic area to the next, you would change frequency and contact the next one. Of course, in addition to just communicating, you had to receive weather reports, en route weather reports, provide any navigational assistance to the navigator from direction finder, and then at the appropriate time you could communicate with your arrival airport to announce your time of arrival. Also, of course, the other main reason was just in case you had an emergency and you would transmit your position and the ground station could act upon it. So
you did that job for 2 years?
I did that for 2 years. When I signed on with BOAC, I had a 2-year contract. At the end of that time, I could have applied for more permanent, but instead I took my gratuity and applied to Skyways, which was a private charter company. The main difference here was that with BOAC, it ran to a timetable, definite times of arrival, departure. But with Skyways, charter meant anywhere, any place, any time. And so our contract, main contracts at this point in time, would be to continue with the runs into the Gulf, various air aerodromes within the Gulf, Basra, Baghdad, Kuwait, Abadan, and also there, if necessary, to bring some of the troops back to England. So this started in the 1946. Right.
So you joined in 1948, Skyways.
Yeah, sorry, I gave the wrong date there. I ended BOAC in 1948 and started with Skyways within a month, 1948.
And it was with Skyways that you became involved in the Berlin airlift?
Yes. We now get to around the middle of 1948, when I applied for a job with Skyways and was taken on there. Initially, we did troops to the Gulf, trooping runs to the Gulf and back. Now, suddenly then, one day, about November of 1948, we were called into the office at our base at Dunsfold in Surrey, where it was explained to us that the government wanted civil aircraft to participate in the Berlin airlift. Explain the terms of reference, if you like. There was no need for navigators because the whole system would be underground, under radar directions. And a crew of three would be required: the captain, the first officer, and the radio officer. No stewards or anything like that. So, also they sort of mentioned that we would go out there for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, then come back to England and perhaps have a spot of leave, and then go back again as required necessary. Accommodation, food, etc. would be provided. We will get allowances per day, which seemed quite generous, and that was it. Of course, at that time, being a civilian, one didn't sort of refuse a job, so one accepted it. And eventually, by the end of November of 48, there I was. Now, is this now going to become a separate?
Yeah. I think we've probably just...
You've got all my background stuff now.
We start a new reel, that's alright. George Co. Reel 4. You arrived in Germany in late November 1948.
At the end of November in 1948, I found myself as a passenger in a DH Domini Dragon Rapide aircraft on my way to RAF Wunsdorf, which was the start of my airlift experience.
Did you remain at Wunnersdorf throughout the whole of your time in Germany?
Did I what?
Did you stay at Wunnersdorf?
No. Now, initially, we got into Wunnersdorf.